Welcome everybody here. For those of you that weren't here the last week or 2 weeks, we are continuing our study on the book of James. And we are ready for chapter 3, verse 1. Next week I'm going to be taking a break. We've got a wedding we want to go to in Indiana, so that gives you guys all a break. So either enjoy one more session or endure one more session, as the case may be. And then we'll finish up after that. So chapter 3 starts in with a strange one, and I... Well, let's read it. Verse 1. My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater damnation. Now, to me, that was confusing. I read it over and over, and I didn't get anywhere, so I went to the New English Version. It reads a little different. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. Which really raised the question, why am I here? What am I doing up here? Getting myself into trouble? Or what's your take on that? Should I head right back to my seat? Should we all have that attitude? Any of you got any thoughts on it? I didn't come up with a lot, and I'm curious what you have. If something if everybody got scared of that at that verse and refused to teach, we would end up with a whole congregation of people like they ended up in the Old Testament times there, where each man did that which was right in his own eyes. And there was no working together, because everybody was on their own. And that isn't really good either. So if not, go ahead, Mike.
I stole an idea from Matthew Henry, but the thought was that if you teach as a judge or as a lecturer or something like that with a lot of authority, then you open yourself up to criticism. If you teach as someone that is equal to everyone else and is one that also wants to learn, then you don't lift yourself up to that plateau and open yourself up to that kind of judgment.
Thank you. I had to think back just now to the lesson that Ron has taught me a couple times over. Never take one verse by itself. So let's read on. Verse 2, for in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same as a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. So we're all fallen human. Everybody has his own weakness in different areas. But according to this, it appears like everybody has a weakness in the area of speech. Am I reading that all wrong? And if that's the case, which actually I kind of think maybe it is, It's one thing to surround ourselves with accountability and willpower and everything else and decide that, no, I'm not going to smoke, or I'm not going to drink, or I'm not going to steal, I'm not going to break the law anywhere. Maybe that's possible. Is it possible to never mess up in speech? I'm thinking, according to this and some of the musing that I did on it, that perhaps speech is harder, our speech is harder to control or keep in order than any other activity. Now I'm not sure whether I'm going to make that as a rock solid statement, but I do toss it out there as an idea. And maybe that's just because that's my weak area, I don't know. Maybe that's the case. But for me, depending who I'm working with for a day, and they offer me a beer, it's easier for me to say no to that. No thanks, I don't drink. That is much easier to me than if they're a foul-mouthed bunch. I find myself joining them a lot quicker in that area. Now maybe that's just my weakness, I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. Moving on, James makes a couple of illustrations on this. The tongue is a fairly small member, substantially smaller than a hand or a foot or an arm or a leg. Substantially smaller than a brain. And he points out that just because it's small doesn't mean it doesn't have a lot of influence on where we're going or what our life, as far as shaping our life. The first illustration he uses is a horse. Behold, we put bits in a horse's mouths that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Now, for those of you that grew up driving a horse, this is fairly simple to understand. For those of you that didn't, there's a whole lot of confusing looking straps and buckles and what have you to a horse's harness. But really the only parts that are about controlling the horse are the bit and the two reins or lines going back to the driver. The rest is about pulling the load. As far as steering, stopping, and starting, that's all. It's just two long straps and a piece of metal rod with a ring at each end. That's it. That's what steers and controls the horse. And if you have an unruly horse, you get a fancier looking bit with a little curve in it that when you pull, it wedges his mouth open, which he doesn't like, and therefore he's going to be more obliging. With a bit, the proper bit, and a good set of reins, you can control a 1,500-pound horse, even a heavy draft horse, 2,000 pounds, relatively easily. Unless, of course, he's a real rebel and needs some training, but still. And all the rest of that harness is just about connecting him to the load so that he can stop and start the load. So the little bit, any child can lift it really, is what controls it. It directs that whole horse in his life, his path. Just like our little tongue often shapes the world we live in. I mean, if we got a sharp, harsh tongue, we're probably going to find those around us kind of greedy and difficult. The next illustration you use is a sailing ship. And I'm not really familiar with what the sailing ships on the Mediterranean in this era would have looked like, but I picture the kind of pictures we learned, saw at school when we were learning about Columbus. So you got three masts and three or four sails per mast and ropes and pulleys and tackle all over the place. Confusing. And then at the back bottom of the boat, there's this chunk of wooden paddle, if you will, controlled by another series of ropes and a wheel. And again, everything from the deck up, as big and monstrous and complicated as it looks, it's about making it go. The little stick and the little paddle in the back is what turns it left and right and decides where it's going to go. These big, huge sails, impressive as they look, that's just to catch the wind and make it go. That's the propulsion system, not the steering. And then he ties it all together in verse 5. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. So our mouth, as we sometimes refer to it, actually has the ability to shape, direct, and to a point control our lives, our speech. And I'm preaching to myself, not you. I should have a big mirror here. That's the foundation of it. Now we're going to go about controlling it. Anybody want to jump in?
It almost appears, perhaps, as if James just has a random thought at the start when he says, "Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. For we all stumble in many ways, and if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man." I think that he is likely putting that on us, or on. He is showing the gravity of a teacher. The teacher teaches with his tongue, and the teacher has the ability to steer the ship or turn or steer horses.
I agree. I was going to try to come back later and tie that all in, but thanks. It is connected, I believe. Jonathan, did you have something you wanted to up here? Jonathan.
It's an interesting thought in the beginning there. I would have never looked at that as referring to, could we say, a negative way of speaking or a positive way, or two different ways of teaching. I guess I always looked at that as more just a general statement, because he seems to include himself. He says, "Let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment." So it's not just the people that teach in the wrong way or that teach in the right way. It's just a general statement that teachers receive a stricter judgment. And he seems to include himself in that. And then he goes on to say, "For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man." And I haven't looked at that word, but I'm suspecting that word perfect might mean mature. Be interesting to someone has any thoughts on that. But further on, I just want to throw out, he says that no man, in verse 8, no man can tame the tongue. It seems all-inclusive. He doesn't just say that wicked people can't control their tongue or that non-believers can't control their tongue. He just makes a general, all-encompassing statement that no one can tame their tongue. Wondered if there's anyone has any thoughts on that.
Anybody want to tackle that one? Somebody want to argue it? Somebody here that knows they can? In verse 5, reading the latter half, starting again at the start, even so the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our neighbors, our members, that it defileth the whole body, setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. Did somebody know? Our tongues, I think sometimes I neglect to give it credit for what it's capable of. We all know that words have the power to heal and lift up, and other words have the power to knock down and emotionally hurt people. But it goes even deeper than that. It can start wars. Yeah, often I think I neglect to respect or fear my tongue like I should. A man skillful with his mouth can get a whole auditorium of folks riled up simply by talking. Just talking. Not do a thing. Get them all riled up and angry. And the next man can calm everybody down. But so often when we look around us, at the world in general, tongues for the most part get used towards the negative more than the positive. I think the scenarios where big groups of people get riled up about somebody's talking are far more numerous than the ones where they get calmed down and healed and directed to real truth. In a lot of ways, I feel like I'm really not understanding what this section means, I don't know why. I'm getting the feeling that I'm just skimming the top here. But maybe I didn't put my proper Jonathan up here. Maybe I didn't put the proper research in. Maybe I didn't study enough.
There's one thought I had with this whole thing about no man can tame the tongue. If you go down to verse 10 or 11, maybe, does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? So he's saying the problem is that out of the same mouth is coming conflicting things, you know, blessing and cursing. And so he's saying, can a spring send forth good water and bad? So whatever comes out of the spring is what's in the spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
The spring can't shoot something out that is not in the reservoir. So he's saying normally it's either the spring is good or bad. So if it's good, we know good water is going to come out. If it's bad, we know bad water is going to come out. So in nature, that's usually how it is. It's either good or bad, and whatever is in it comes out. Jesus said that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So whatever the heart is full of, that's going to be what comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you can't help it, that's just what comes out. Whatever your heart is full of, that's just what spews out. So when he says, no, you can't tame your tongue, I think it's important for us to understand that I can't, whatever's in me is going to come out. I can't control that. So the solution is to make sure that I'm full of good things, so that whatever comes out is good. Because I can't control my tongue. Whatever's in here is going to come out, so just make sure I'm full of good things. That's usually how I've looked at that as an answer to how to make sure that whatever comes out of me is good, because I can't keep it from coming out.
Okay, yeah. And is that what he's saying in verse 9 too? Or verse 8 and 9, but the tongue can no man tame, it's an unruly evil, full of deadly poison, wherewith we bless God, even the Father, and therewith we curse men, which are made after the similitude of God. I guess the same applies, doesn't it? But why does he say then that, why does he label the tongue as evil? Rather than go ahead over here, Alvin. Yes.
Verse 6. The Amplified says, and the tongue is a fire. The tongue is a world of wickedness set among our members, contaminating and depraving the whole body, setting on fire the wheel of nature, in brackets, the cycle of man's nature being itself ignited by hell. Just adds a bit of thought to our nature was ignited in the wrong way by Lucifer from that source. By nature, we are ignited by evil passion. And so I believe we have a treasure in earthen vessels. Not like our bodies have Christ in our body, but we have faith in Christ, and we are filled with that treasure. Jesus Christ is the treasure that's going to change the thing that spews from our mouth.
I don't think it actually says that we can't control the tongue. It says we can't tame it. And a wild animal, you can tame it till it won't run away on you. But some of them you can only control with a chain or something. And once it's tamed, you don't have to watch it. And our tongue will never be that way. We can't tame our tongue. But there's examples where people have trained or controlled their tongue. But you still have to be watchful. Just a thought.
Thank you. That's a good point. Anybody else want to jump in on it?
I was just thinking about the tongue. We can look up at the projector here, and we can put good stuff through there or bad stuff, right? We could throw photos up on the screen that would edify, or photos that would corrupt us. Really, our tongue is just reveals what's inside. We can control it, but that's not going to change us. I don't know, has anybody ever gone away from a meeting or from a discussion and said, did I just say that? And think back, and we just see our own hearts exposed. And I think that can be a good thing to ourselves, that we can gauge our own hearts by our words. And hearts are really what have to be changed if our tongue is going to be edifying, if our tongue is going to bring forth words of spring of life.
I agree with that, and I was thinking of along those lines as well, back to Jonathan's comment of what we put in is what comes out, just like the spring. And although our hearts are pure, and although we're perfect, we all know we're in the flesh. And when we fail, I think the tongue is one of the first places that can show up. And we all know we do fail at times. And so the tongue is one of the surface outworkings of a heart that is string.
This is just my 10 cents, but he's talking about teachers in verse 1. And then he goes on about the ship and all that and how this tongue can steer a great thing. But if you just pick up the thought of teachers and move down to verse 14. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic. I think a lot of people spend a lot of time making sure they don't swear or say things that are not kosher or kosher with the group they're in. But we don't often think about what is implied by what we say, even though it has religious overtones or... Because in every culture, we know what's implied by what's said and not said, right? And it's very hard to actually pick it up and say, okay, this is what we've all been there, right? And I think James is shooting deeper as men and women who instruct people in righteousness. If we're motivated by these fleshly desires in our hearts, we'll take the ship the wrong way. Versus a godly person can turn a hopeless mess around by implying the proper spiritual truths. And he won't necessarily be the man or woman with a pious tongue. He'll just be honest, truthful, and you'll know the truth when you hear it. But he won't necessarily be... I don't know how to say that for sure, but... and then chapter 4, it says, where do fights and wars come from among you? Do not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members. You've seen two Christian brothers fighting amongst themselves intensely, and they're all saying, God bless you, and yes, brother, and all that, but they're getting nowhere because they're just liars. If they would just pull that veil off and just say it, they could then get to some higher ground, right? I think that's what James is talking about here. And he admits, like John said in the beginning, that we all struggle with this. Verse 2 said, we all stumble. Thank God. James is asking us to repent and move on to higher ground.
Anybody else? I like this when you guys are talking. I'm learning too. Still trying to process some of that. So there's been some comments on some said on verse 7 and 8. I don't know whether I even want to bother sharing what I had on it, but I guess I will, to be fair. So man can tame wild beasts, even snakes in some cases, with enough time anyway. But no amount of time and effort can tame the tongue. And my conclusion there was only faith and its resulting obedience. Only faith in Christ and its resulting obedience will affect the tongue or affect our speech. But I still kind of like that thought where we can't actually tame it, but we can control it. Do I, have I got that right? Or have I got that mixed up now? And the way to control it is to feed it like a spring, feed it good, not bitter. Did you have one there? No? Jonathan up here.
I don't want to harp on the point too much, but I wonder, is the issue here really controlling the tongue? Is that necessary? Is that important? You know, I think of the disciples, for instance. They said, we cannot but speak the things that we have seen and heard. So I'm not so concerned about controlling my tongue. I'm just concerned that what I speak is good. Because I want to, it seemed like when I look at the disciples in a statement like that, it's like, we can't help but speak, you know, so... And we all would say, well, that's a good thing. Keep speaking, because what you're saying is really good. It needs to be heard. So I'm just suggesting that the issue here is not so much, or correct me if I'm wrong, it's just my thoughts here that I'm wondering, can I throw it out as a question, is the issue so much controlling the tongue, or is the issue making sure that what comes out of our tongue is good?
And by making sure what comes out is good, we're saying that we're not so much watching our tongue for what comes out of it, but we're feeding it with what we want coming out of it, and that's so that we don't have to control it, we just let it flap. Okay, like the apostles.
There's a story in the Old Testament. The ministry had just started under the tabernacle, and Aaron's sons, and the Aaron and Moses had done their duty, and God came, it says, and the glory of the Lord appeared and consumed the offering. And the very next chapter, chapter 10 of Leviticus, is a story of Nadab and Abihu. And I wonder what their motive was for taking fire themselves. The Lord calls it strange fire. And as I'm been listening to all this about from verse 1 to the end of the chapter, and we think about leaders turning a ship, isn't it usually the problem in a church between among the leaders, among those who teach and preach, because there becomes envy and jealousy and rivalry, just like he says here? But he says that's actually more devilish. He makes his point, it seems like he rises that higher than almost anything else in the church, or in this scripture at least. But he says things that are heavenly and from above are first peaceable and pure. What are the other words there? But there's a lot of calm. There's no envy. There's no rivalry. There's a oneness, a unity. There's the spirit of... It is really a picture of the spirit of Christ at work among human beings. And so, yes, it puts fear in our heart to think of being leaders in a church or being teachers in a church or teachers, period, right?
When God's Spirit dwells inside, often you find that He's faithful to give you the nudge when it is or isn't time to speak, and to be being mindful of those promptings and those nudges often can save us from saying a lot of harmful things.
Anyone else? Ron?
I'd just like to back up what Jonathan said there. I agree with him. you know, any other sin in our life, let's say I have a problem with stealing, I don't try to control that stealing. I ask God to redeem me and take away the love of theft. Cleanse me from it. I want to walk free, right? And all of the other sins that we talk about in the Bible, right? And so I think it's the same with our tongue. I don't think we're wise to say, well, Lord, just help me to hold my tongue when it's going to matter, and when it doesn't matter, I'm not going to try as hard. That, you know, that isn't a wise way to walk, I don't think. We need to ask the Lord to change us. You know, or at least that's what I'd want for myself. I'd like to be changed so that when it just, because it's, if you're a talkative person, it just happens so fast, right? Before you ever even thought about it, it was already out of your mouth. And that's a something the Lord just has to change, right? And we can't by ourselves do that. But God can still do miracles. And I just wanted to back up that comment. I think that's true.
Yeah, I agree. But in view of that, so we're going to go with the... So we just... Ray, go ahead.
I sort of agree, but not entirely. I mean, the reality is that I agree that I want to make sure that what comes out of my mouth, what I use my tongue for, is good entirely. Sometimes I have to control my tongue to make sure that's the way it is. And I think most of us do. If we don't, if that's not the case, if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man and also able to bridle his whole body. That perfect man, his whole being, is aligned with the will of God, which is what we want all the time. Mm-hmm. If that's not the case, every once in a while it will show in what we speak. And if it doesn't, you're either perfect or you've become very good at controlling your tongue. I think it's a slavery to have to control your tongue at all times, because you just constantly have to, you know, keep a damper on it. And I don't think that's what James is talking about. But I do think there is a time in most of our lives, regardless how mature you are as a Christian, where it's better to control your tongue. It's better not to say what you're thinking.
Much as we'd all like to achieve this ideal condition of our hearts overflowing with nothing but good, to the point where we don't have to worry about controlling our tongue and everything that comes out of our mouth is good. I mean, I think we'd all think that'd be perfect. But we're all fallen humans in the process of progressive sanctification, and we're not quite there yet. So I think we all fall into this category where that's what we want, that's what we're working towards, that's what we're asking God for. But as we grow, or while we grow, we still need to do a little bit of biting our tongue once in a while. And most of us, or at least for myself, sometimes I even have to back up a bit and ask for forgiveness, because I'm not yet fully sanctified. It seems to be a work in progress. And I'm going to guess that I'm not that much different than other humans, so I have to assume that to some degree all of you are working with some of that. You had one in here somewhere, if you still want. No? Okay, never mind then. So moving on. We kind of agree that with that statement that one source, whether it be a tree or a spring or the tongue, only brings forth what's in it. And that at the same time, Satan is trying to feed negative into it. Thirteen, he kind of starts angling into wisdom. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. But if ye have bitter envyings and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, and devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure and then peaceable, gentle and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. So we'd reached in here a little. Verse 13. Who is wise and full of knowledge? It almost appears to me like this verse is for those that believe themselves to be wise and full of knowledge. Go ahead.
I'm going to read it in another translation.
Yes, please.
If you are wise and understand God's ways, prove it by living an honorable life, doing good works with humility that comes from wisdom. So you ask, who's wise and full of knowledge? It's the man that lives according to the will of God and by that way proves.
Okay, I guess that makes no rest for me then. Here I thought, well, I'm not wise and full of knowledge, so I can skip that one and I'm off the hook. Go ahead. Did you have your hand up, Ray?
No. Ties again in exactly with what John said, out of the abundance of the heart, like the source. And if your life is righteous, it all comes out at the mouth.
So now not only is our faith revealed by our works, like we discussed last Sunday, it's also revealed by how we talk and our wisdom. It appears like there's no hiding this. And how is wisdom shown to those around us? In a lot of cases, by how we, what we talk, what we say, and what we do. So we're not even out of the woods yet, as far as this section of controlling the tongue. Now my note on verse 14 and 15 say, this is, some of this is, it's kind of interesting reading my notes from a week and a half ago. If your knowledge and wisdom produces envying and strife, it is not of God, but earthly. So by implication, it's saying that if it doesn't produce envying and strife, then it is of God. And isn't that what he's saying in verse 17 and 18? Godly wisdom and speech produces unity and peace Wisdom that is from above is pure and peaceable and gentle, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do think that's what he's saying. He's setting out extreme opposites. The person with selfish ambition in his heart is partial. He can't be impartial because he's partial to himself. He's probably not open to reason because he's not impartial. All reasonableness must flow through the grid of his mind for the good of himself. So I think from 15, verse 15 and 17, he's setting out extreme opposites.
Thank you. Yeah. The other point I had was godly wisdom. Our wisdom is always lived out. Wisdom being possibly like worldview or our view of how things function as a whole is always lived out. But if that view is aligned with God's view of humanity and this earth, then our life and speech is peaceable. Peaceable and gentle, not grating and argumentative or sometimes I wonder, like, even the word debate, which side of the coin that one falls on. Like, we debate this and that. Debates can easily cross the line, I believe, into arguments. And our conversation, even amongst ourselves, the wisdom we share with each other, wisdom maybe being in quotations, reveal again what the spring is actually made of. Anybody have anything else you want to add to that? That concludes the end of my notes. And I guess it's time to wrap things up anyway. So, yeah. What's inside's going to come out. Let's fix the source. And let's face the fact that we can't fix the source on our own. That's where we come right back to the whole thing of faith. Thank you.